very grateful that you trust me with her. At the moment, Lori was a priceless American jewel. My teaching and mentorship style had matured since my Zendaya days, to the point that I was confident I could do Lori justice. That day, Wanda Hernandez invited me to their house for dinner. I met Lori's father and her siblings. The Hernandez family did not live in a fancy house, nor the kind of huge mansion that you see in some Jersey communities. They were a blue-collar family from the suburbs. I recognized the atmosphere right away. It felt familiar to me. I was a Chmerkovsky in a Hernandez household, but it felt like I was home, eating not the most lavish five-star dinner, but a meal that was indescribably finer, because it was so clearly served with love. By the time we were finished and sitting contentedly over our café con leche, they knew they had the right guy, and I knew I had just completely lucked out with my partner. One of my first events with Lori was a promo shoot the next day at a high-end photography studio in Manhattan. The single aspect of Dancing with the Stars that floored all of my partners was the costumes. It didn't matter what kind of celebrity they were, the costumes got them every time. When the stars see that stuffed full rack from Dancing with the Stars, oh man, the glittery stuff and the rhinestone dresses, they got a hint of what they were in for. I could just imagine what the moment was like for a 16-year-old girl, one who had deprived herself of a normal life for the last decade, chasing the single-minded dream of an Olympic gold medal. The friendship she didn't get to develop, the movies she didn't go to, all the cake and candy she didn't eat, every awesome childhood thing under the sun, Lori had to sacrifice for her goal. She broke her wrists and legs. She was constantly sore all over and in pain, just to be able to earn the reward of standing up straight and proud as her national anthem was played for the world to hear. So for her, that costume rack was the first tiny taste of those rewards that she had labored for over the course of 11 years. It was a beautiful moment. She was a kid at a candy store. I helped her choose the dress that would be appropriate for the photo shoot, made sure the shoes fit, cut off the excess material to make sure the soles would be slick for the picture. I ran around like a butler in a palace. I knew first impressions were vital, and I always felt like I was a kind of ambassador for the show. I wanted the family to understand that their daughter was in the best of hands. "Do you want some food?" I asked, then turned to Wanda. "Are you okay? Would you like something to drink?" I told her about my mom carting me around to rehearsals and lessons, knowing the stories would sound familiar. They were getting to know me now. I spoke to the stylists. "Well, what about the makeup? Can we make it a little brighter, a little younger?" I was there every step of the way. When we entered into our rehearsal period, Lori was on a national gymnastics tour, so I would fly around the country to meet her and grab her for a few minutes of practice time. Once again, I was immersed in the old routine of rehearsing in hallways, green rooms, the wing of an auditorium. Remember what I told you about the Dancing with the Stars audience being tuned in to the dancers' growth across the season rather than their expertise? It was that way with Lori. We started out on the first episode with the Cha-Cha to American Girl, the perfect song for who she was at that moment in her life. Although we tied for first on that premiere episode, for the first 3 weeks, the judges never marked us higher than a score of 8. The fourth week had a Cirque du Soleil theme, and Lori and I did a jazz piece to Michael Jackson's The Way You Make Me Feel, with acrobats performing around and behind us. The effect was spectacular, and that show was a turning point. The judges gave us perfect 10s, the highest score for any couple on the show. Lori had always been a favorite to win the season. Coming off her Olympic gold, how could she not be? But from that routine onwards, she and I took our place as the front runners. We never looked back. I was sad for her, though, because Olympic swimmer Ryan Lochte was in the cast that season, and the scandal about his behavior in Rio swirled all over the media, taking up a lot of attention. That season featured other strange moments, such as rapper Vanilla Ice doing a number MC'd by Texas governor and current Secretary of Energy, Mr. Rick Perry. We had it all on Dancing with the Stars. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Because nothing could stop Lori and me. For the last 4 episodes, from Halloween night and Showstoppers night to the semifinals and the finals, we were marked with perfect scores 24 times and earned only 2 9s. Lori had to find room on her shelves for a Mirabeau trophy to go along with the Olympic medals and the gymnastic awards. I wound up with much more than a second trophy. In that wonderful whirlwind of a season, Lori taught me that, like love, inspiration was a two-way street. Sometimes experience can batter you into changing, but sometimes it can lift you up and transform you with a sense of joy rather than agony. I just want to thank everyone for their support and riding along this crazy roller coaster of my life, Lori said after winning. Then she continued with words after my own heart. My goal is just to inspire others as I go on with my journey. Lori and I took our place among couples with the highest averages on Dancing with the Stars, and we're ranked in the top 20 at least behind my brother, who led the pack in his championship season with Merrill Davis. But who's counting? Harmony. In the spring of 2017, leading up to season 24 of Dancing with the Stars, I felt for the first time that a case of burnout was sneaking up on me. For one thing, I had done 11 seasons in a row and was now committed to doing a 12th. Like college students who stop out for a year in the midst of their educations, pros on the show take seasons off all the time. Sometimes they're just not hired that year, and sometimes they step out by their own choice. When you don't see the best of the professionals on our show, most likely they've been asked to participate but decided they needed a season off because they were burnt out or just wanted to pursue other opportunities. That wasn't me. Over the course of 6 years since I had signed on as a pro dancer, I had never stepped out. I pursued my other opportunities during the mid-season breaks while still banging out the shows simply because I loved it. But like they say, when you're broke, you have the time, and when you finally got some money, you ain't got the time. My schedule had been relentless. I was coming off 5 straight mid-season tours, both my own and ones with Dancing with the Stars cast. The 2016 and 17 winter off-season Dancing with the Stars tour was the best attended yet, selling something like 130,000 tickets. That was more than ticket sales for the first two arena tours combined, back in the good old days when the show tours had just begun. Screw the good old days. These were the good old days, and I was living them in the moment. My status as one of the leading pro dancers on Dancing with the Stars was hard won. I had just made it to the top with Lori Hernandez. I had managed to solidify my position as the new sheriff in town. I had always wanted to be the guy, and now that I had realized my goal and had become the guy, one of them anyway, I should have felt happy and fulfilled. Hey, by the way, I would humble brag. Have you heard that I just took home my second Mirabeau trophy? So I was living the life. Out on the road with Dancing with the Stars tour, I got to witness the reaction of the fans, see the country, and become familiar with every nook and cranny of the United States of America. What could be better? But somehow, a tiny element of doubt crept into my mind. Was I personally being fulfilled? I felt like an ungrateful little shit, but if I was honest with myself, I had to admit that, no? I wasn't fulfilled. It drove me crazy, because I was facing what's called a first world problem, you know? Get everything you want, live the high life, pin on your new sheriff star. What the hell? You're still not satisfied? I could not dodge the feeling. The basic question I posed to myself was the same as it always was. Was I growing? Financially, yes, indeed. My bank account was growing. But was that all there is? Was I growing as a person? My true wealth came from an inner sense of growth, of transformation, of connection. Way back in those meet and greets during my first season on the show, I had realized that connection was important to me. I needed to learn about other people, and to do that, I needed to experience other cultures. I learned through travel and learned through immersing myself in history. That kind of activity was just incredibly fulfilling for me, and that's what I was missing. I spent most of my younger years traveling overseas to competitions. All the family money went into the air ticket to Berlin for me to dance in the German Open, or to Prague, or to Turin, Moscow, London. Without really being aware of it, I became bit by bit a true cosmopolitan, a citizen of the world. By my early 20s, I found myself having worldly conversations with older adults discussing, say, the intricacies of the architecture by Gaudí in Barcelona, how inspired I was by its impact on public space in the city. Gaudí's genius of cutting all the corners of his structures creates little squares throughout the city, and that allows more opportunity, spatially, to erect monuments or install pieces of art. Huh? Had those words really come out of little Vila's mouth? I was 24 and still a kid, but I had been all over the world. I could speak confidently about my architectural impressions or about how I thought the south of France was overrated or about the time I spent at Blackpool or on the island of Capri. Hey, I just stayed in Naples with my boy Nino Langella for a couple of weeks, I'd find myself saying. Tough as nails environment, but a really picturesque place. But all that travel had taken place before my tenure on Dancing with the Stars. In the years since, my international forays had been cut off, and through tours and appearances, I'd been instead immersed in the exhaustive and exhausting exploration of America. It was the best thing ever, because I got to know the greatest country in the world, inside and out. But for a 5-year stretch, I had essentially been landlocked in the States. Thinking it over, I decided that I was missing my old vagabond days of globetrotting. I mean, maybe I had been a little fucking nuts to have gone on 5 straight off-season tours. I lived on stage, and I thought that was all that mattered to me. Talk about the Grateful Dead. Me and the rest of the pros on this tour were like the Grateful Dancing Dead. I used to have dreams about being on a tour bus while I was actually asleep on the Dancing with the Stars tour bus. Living out of a suitcase became more comfortable to me than having a home. I felt less anxiety just having a suitcase, because there were fewer decisions to be made every morning. Question to myself on the road, which shirt am I going to wear today? Answer, the same motherfucking shirt you wore yesterday, bro. Our super successful off-season tour was over, and that spring I was headed into my next appearance as pro on Dancing with the Stars. There were other elements contributing to my unease, like the breakup of a 4-month relationship. In the week-long stretch between the end of the tour and the start of the season, I took my nagging little doubts to a 4-day yoga retreat in Arizona, trying to sort everything out. I was coming up on my 31st birthday and for the first time in my life had some respectable digits in my bank account. I wasn't exactly Bill Gates, but at least I could buy my mom a gift, help my family, help my friends. I finally got to be the man of my little tribe. That had been the motivating goal of my life for as long as I could remember. I always sent out the same message to whomever supported me. Wait till I make it. I'll give you way more than you've ever given me. I'll give back to you tenfold on this shit. I'm the best investment you guys ever made. So I was able to fulfill those promises, but while I was out there doing a downward-facing dog in the desert air of Arizona, the question still remained. What about me? What did I want for myself? I was blessed to have work, but at some point, to be effective in my work, I had to mandate a moment for myself as a human being, to recharge my batteries. I had to travel. Not just in America either, but in the wide world of Europe, Asia, fucking Oceania, if I wanted to. I had a contract for another season on Dancing with the Stars, and I would do what I signed up for. But I decided I was not going to commit to another off-season tour. My brother was getting married that July, and I couldn't just take a couple of days off from a tour for that. After 5.5 years of ping-ponging between non-stop tours and seasons on primetime TV, I promised myself a breather. I was going to live my life. Extricating myself from the lotus position, I left Arizona and returned to LA to find out who I'd been matched with for season 25. Your new partner is going to be doing this event at a rodeo in Houston, the producer told me. We want you to do the first meeting segment with her there. We ended up shooting the footage in front of 70,000 people at the NRG Stadium, normally where the Houston Texans played their home games in the NFL. The biggest rodeo in the world was happening at the venue that night, with girl group megastars Fifth Harmony as featured entertainers. I went along mainly because later in life, I would be able to say that trademark line, "This is not my first rodeo." The scene in the stadium totally blew my mind. I'd never been to a rodeo before, and I had never been around so much horseshit outside of Hollywood. I waited in the wings as Fifth Harmony took the stage. Normani Corday is about to do Dancing with the Stars, the MC called out, naming one of the group's singers. Surprise, folks. Here is her new dance partner. I came on stage, and the audience cheered like crazy. It made for an epic moment, definitely in keeping with my new partner's celebrity status. I was shocked at first, in the same way I had been shocked that Rumor Willis had wanted to do the show. Normani Corday was a huge star, a member of the biggest-selling all-female pop group since the Spice Girls. I was stunned that somebody of her stature would sign on. Dancing with the Stars was a hard project to do, a pretty intense gig. When you're busy with your own career, why in the world would you want to embark on a super difficult journey of doing the show? Oddly enough, Normani had joined Fifth Harmony courtesy of another reality TV talent show, X Factor, when she tried out as a solo singer and hadn't made the cut. However, producer Simon Cowell saw something in her, recruiting four other singers who had also tried out and failed as X Factor solo acts, and put them together to create Fifth Harmony. Even though some pop stars tended to be a little diva-ish, I immediately felt quite an opposite vibe from Normani. I got a peek behind the pop star curtain and saw an unpretentious, fairly insecure, 20-year-old girl who struck me as being really down. Down was, of course, one of the Fifth Harmony's big hit songs. Normani came across as somewhat lost and at the same time excited, but with no real idea what the upcoming experience would be like. The only reference point she had was X Factor, an experience that for her had been all anxiety and intimidation. "We're going to be working really hard," I told her. "Are you ready for that? What are you doing in the meantime? Do you even have time for this show?" "I'm a huge fan of Dancing with the Stars," Normani said, dodging the question. "I've watched nearly every season with my grandma. Grandma Barbara is an expert. She loves you. She keeps a catalog of everyone who's been on." For myself, I was excited to have Normani as a partner, because she was a performer, so at least we had that element in place. But I had seen Fifth Harmony in concert, and I wondered how much her experience in the group was going to transfer. She was expected to look pretty on stage, with minimal movement including some shallow, no offense, commercial type of choreo. "Look in the camera, smile, touch your boobs, and keep it moving." I knew Dancing with the Stars process had a lot more to it than that. Houston was Normani's home turf. She was from New Orleans and lived there for years before Katrina hit. Her parents had just moved into the house of their dreams when the hurricane came and swept their whole life away. As did many other Katrina refugees, the family relocated to Houston, where Normani's dance teacher became a second mother to her. Just as it had been for me when my family relocated, dance became Normani's escape, and the dance studio served as a safe haven from all the craziness going on in her world. I guess someone was listening when I wished that I could travel the world again, since season 25 turned out to be the most outrageously elaborate, multi-leg, frequent flyer, jet-set trek I've ever accomplished in my life. For the first 3 weeks of the show, Normani was on a multi-stop tour of Asia with her group, Fifth Harmony. I went along to rehearse with her, feeling as though I had been sucked into the pop star whirlwind. Our schedule turned insane. We ended up doing Dancing with the Stars live as usual on Monday night, going straight from the show to LAX, getting on a flight to Asia that night, crossing the dateline, and landing on Wednesday morning. The Fifth Harmony tour started with Okinawa, then moved on to Tokyo, Hong Kong, Philippines, Malaysia, and Singapore. 1 week, because of the schedule crunch, Normani would end up flying red-eye back to L.A. to arrive on Monday morning, with only minutes to spare for the car ride to Television City. If there had been a cyclone over the Pacific, which happens all the time during that season, she would have never had made the live show. I pictured myself trying to explain to America that, believe it or not, this was actual live television, where shit happens, and obviously, shit felt like it always happened to me. Normani was a girl who traveled with a lot of bags, and she was flying internationally, where there were so many factors that could cause delays. What made the whole business easier was having a field producer along from Dancing with the Stars who really knew his craft. Adam from Staten Island, New York City. We meshed perfectly and shared a lot of common experiences. He was a diehard basketball fan with a New York Knicks hat. We were cut from the same cloth. I had grown up making fun of losers from Staten Island all my life, and when we were together, the trash talk flowed both ways. Plus, he was the absolute best camera person in terms of getting shots in the middle of crazy, exotic settings. One way or another, Adam would figure it out, because he had that confident, not to say cocky, attitude of a native New Yorker. He didn't need release signatures, because he knew how to duck the camera in order to get the shot with no bystanders involved. He understood what it took to put a package together without having to shoot hours of footage for a one-minute spot. With Adam operating the camera and the girls of Fifth Harmony as willing participants, we fucking killed it. Far from being a grind, going on tour with Normani actually wound up being the best time. In fact, one of the best times I've ever had on the show. I know you've heard that from me before, but it's true, and it's actually how it should be. I always want my last season to be the best one. The accepted wisdom on music tours has advised stars to stay cool and not get involved with the locals. Sit in the hotel and just chill. I wasn't having any of that. We're in Malaysia, man, let's go. Or, I've been to Hong Kong before and you gotta see this. Or, this is Tokyo and I know a great place in the Ginza area. We ended up celebrating my 31st birthday in Tokyo. I took out Fifth fucking Harmony to the Kill Bill restaurant, the one recreated for the movie. All of a sudden, I'm at a hibachi dinner preaching to them about how great they are and how individually they will do everything they want to do, but together they have the opportunity not just to provide for each other, but to inspire and entertain and make so many people happy. If I hadn't been dancing on the show, they would have hired me as their manager right there and then. While I had my usual understanding that I had to make allies of Normani's parents, I knew it was equally important to build a partnership with her group, because that was her second family. If the members of Fifth Harmony felt invited to be a part of her journey on the show, they'd be a lot more supportive of me taking her away every 10 minutes to work on our cha-cha. And Normani herself would be more likely to open up to me and to the whole Dancing with the Stars experience. I wanted Normani Corday to be able to communicate her truth to the audience. To do that, she had to come from the point of safety and comfort. I'm actually not all about that onstage sass. I'm a young girl and I have insecurities just like you do. That was a message she wanted to convey to the world, and for the first time in her life, she had the opportunity to do so. After dinner, we hit a club where a friend of mine from New York was DJing. We hung out, they danced, and everybody bonded. I sat next to their longtime tour manager, Will Bracey, somebody who would become a solid friend. "Bro, I've been touring with these girls for years now," Will told me. "I mean, they've appeared everywhere, seen it all, done it all. I've never seen them have this much fun together before." Part of the reason was in that little Tokyo club, the members of Fifth Harmony were anonymous. The place wasn't packed, but instead resembled a private refuge of our own, with good people, the best vibes, and a sense that we were all in it together. The night changed the group's dynamics, which can get pretty claustrophobic in a pop act, as the Beatles and the Stones and Oasis have demonstrated. It actually did them good to celebrate someone else, to sing happy birthday to me at the airport and to focus on someone outside of the group. That all happened in week one of the season. Dancing with the Stars premiered on March 20th, and my birthday fell 4 days later. I could gauge how Normani's spirits rose, despite the frantic back and forth shuttling across the Pacific. We'd fly nonstop from the Asian tour whirlwind, only to dive into another whirlwind in LA. It was an insane schedule, but somehow it wound up fueling our mutual excitement. For the first time in a long time, she was able to find her purpose as an individual, not just as a member of Fifth Harmony. Just like this book gives me my own voice outside of a television show, Normani found the experience of creating art outside the group to be life-changing. She was better in Fifth Harmony because of it, and I'm better on Dancing with the Stars because I have writing as an outlet. One of the highlights of the season for me was getting to know Normani's grandmother, Barbara, a super sassy lady. In fact, if Normani had half the sass that her grandma had, it would have made surviving in show business much easier for her. Barbara ended up being the guiding spirit behind Normani doing the show, which became a shared experience for them. A long-time Dancing with the Stars fan, she would put together costumes for Normani based on what she saw on the set. But I found out Barbara's secret. She wasn't on Team Val after all. She was on Team Max. From the moment he showed up on season 2, my brother had been her boy. Humble old me, who usually sat first chair with my violin whenever I was in a youth orchestra, had to play second fiddle with Barbara. To be successful on Dancing with the Stars, a celebrity has to connect to the audience. How could people relate to a pop phenom who sells out arenas and is a fancy, super sexy 20-year-old? Where's the average human experience in that? The cameos that Normani's grandma made on the show helped, but in the end, we were able to bring out the human connection in the most spectacular manner. That accomplishment was the true Mirabeau trophy, which she and I didn't wind up winning, by the way. In my mind, we did something better. It happened in week 7 of the season. The producers did a special program where the pros were allowed to choose music we thought best suited our celebrity. This was an awesome opportunity for me to take a chance creatively. I picked Freedom, a song by Kelvin Wooten, Anthony Hamilton, and Elena Boynton from the soundtrack of Django Unchained, an intense number that would normally never have been approved for the show. Because of a certain incident that had happened in her past, I thought it fit Normani perfectly. "Look," I said to the producers, "so you're gonna okay this song, right? And we're doing exactly how I said it, right? Because I'm gonna talk about it on camera during rehearsal, and that's how it has to go." 8 months before, in the summer of 2016, Normani had been swept up in a nasty case of cyberbullying that showed just how ugly the internet can be. The incident got triggered by a Facebook Live interview when she was asked to say nice things about each one of her Fifth Harmony bandmates. Normani seemed to hesitate in describing a member who had just left the group. "She is, very quirky? Yeah, very quirky, cute. No big thing, right?" But fans went berserk on social media, reacting way over the top to an offhand comment that they somehow construed as disrespectful. She hadn't gone all gushy the way she was apparently supposed to do. The trolls came out in force. An image showed up online of Normani's face pasted over a historical image of a lynching. So boo-hoo, right? Happens every day. To a certain audience, the reality of cyberbullying doesn't seem like a big deal. Brush it off. Go on with your life. And if you can't stand the heat, blah, blah, blah. But life is different for kids born around the turn of the millennium. Because social media is such an integral part of their world, the nastiness of the internet has become a huge mental health issue for them. Parents used to worry about kids getting bullied on the school playground. Back when children were on the playground for an hour a day, the playground was in the neighborhood and kids knew exactly who the bully was. Nowadays, social media is a 24/7 phenomenon, an endless universe that features some very dark, psychological matter. It's a fake world that has become a generation's reality. I'm a product of it as well, as we all are now to some degree. "Hey, let me get this person," says some rancid little troll staring at a computer screen. "What can I do to her? Oh, look, she's black. Let me pick on that." For the family, it is painful to see a child go through trauma that they can do nothing about. When my brother was robbed for his rollerblades when we first moved to America, at least my dad could come out in his socks, and the punks knew that at some point somebody was going to show up. Nobody could come to Normani's rescue on the internet. How many of the trolls can any single person respond to? How many people could her mom answer? It wasn't happening. Normani grew up in Houston and was Texas through and through. She was an American girl. She's wholesome, goes to church, loves God, and was one of the kindest people I had ever met. Now race was being thrust forward in her life in a very public, very direct way. She wound up being hounded off Twitter because of the bullying. We came up with a piece that worked as an answer to the bullies, but also served as a sort of therapy for Normani's post-traumatic stress. Freedom was a song that seemed to address the whole situation perfectly. felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. Should I break or retreat and then return? But I've come too far to go back now. I am looking for freedom, looking for freedom. And to find it cost me everything I have. I choreographed a routine that opened with Normani stranded in the middle of a mob who were all pointing their fingers at her. She was surrounded, and you could feel the heaviness in the air as I pulled myself into the circle and pulled her out of that reality. We danced a contemporary that symbolized the quest for freedom from all the shitty things in the world, all the repercussions of angry, vile groupthink. My character pushed her to find her strength, find her freedom, help her defeat this mob mentality that had been holding her down. Not giving up has always been hard, so hard. But if I do the things the easy way, I won't get far. We went all in. Normani actually cut her hair for the routine. I dressed her in rags, stripping away the pop star persona she was normally dressed in. As she emerged from the circle of negativity and oppression and we danced, I began screaming at her to break free. Go, go, go. On television, viewers could not hear me yelling, but the live audience could. On camera, everyone sensed my energy. In replays, the shot of the audience showed stunned faces all around. At that moment, Dancing with the Stars ceased to be a pop show and became something else, a testament to the endurance of the human soul. Anybody can be exposed to the nasty side of life, not just the glitz but the shit of life, and how we react makes all the difference. In the routine, Normani came off as strong, so honest, so undeniably vulnerable and human. We ended up in the middle of the circle, fingers pointing at her once again, pointing at her again, but with us looping around and knocking their hands down one by one. They peeled off and we wound up embracing in the center of the floor where she collapsed exhausted into my arms. What I wanted to show with this piece wasn't all negative. I wanted to demonstrate that with the help of maybe just one other person, no matter what situation you're in, you can find the light. It was one of the most important pieces of choreography I've ever done in my life, easily the best dancing I had ever done on the show. All of a sudden, I felt fulfilled. I decided I didn't need to travel to Rome or Barcelona in order to feel that I've grown, that I'd made a connection, that I made a difference. I could cry right now writing about it. With the help of the show, we had recreated some of the most important moments of Normani's life. Forget her entertainment life, her professional life. This gave her validation as a person, as an individual. It brought her family closer. On the surface, the whole world, including me, believed the girl had it all. But deep down, she didn't believe she was talented, didn't think she was worth it, to pun on the title of another Fifth Harmony hit song. I watched her change. She ended the season filled to the brim with overflowing inspiration. She was no longer what the cyberbullies made her out to be, the black girl from the pop group. She had broken free as Normani Corday, as a dignified human, as an artist. Her smile shined brighter than ever, and her voice had more bass to it now. She came of age, and her family was there to witness the transformation. To see her take her life back on her own terms was an incredible thing, and I was a small part of it. Final thoughts. I know it's more than slightly ridiculous, a 31-year-old writing a memoir. Also comical, arrogant, and bizarre, all those things. Shouldn't I have actually lived the life before putting mine down on paper? But I hope this book will be the first of many from yours truly. What you've heard is an account of me growing through a quarter century as a dancer, at times in ballroom competitions, but mostly on a reality show called Dancing with the Stars. And as I said from the get-go, I'm not just a dancer, and I'm not just a Dancing with the Stars guy. Like my fellow Brooklyn homeboy Walt Whitman, I contain multitudes. And yeah, I just compared myself to one of the world's greatest poets. I look forward to a future where I can trot out all my multitudes and dance them around the floor. Next up, I'll Never Change My Layup, a thrilling book about my battles on the hardwood. Looking over these pages, I can see that I wasn't doing my own memoir at all. I was writing a double autobiography of me and my brother. He was and always will be so much a part of me that the phrase my life is meaningless without him being a part of it. At least up until this point in time, it's been more like our life. What I'm most happy about reading over what I wrote is that I can see our relationship had never stood still. It has always evolved, and that it has finally settled into a very good place. We are better friends now, better allies, better people than ever before. When Max married in the summer of 2017, taking for his wife the incredible artist, standout Dancing with the Stars pro, two-time Mirror Bowl winner, and all-around hottie Peter Murgatroyd, he didn't have far to look for a best man. For the occasion, I had to really reflect on our relationship, feeling a great deal of responsibility to try to voice what my brother means to me as best as I could. It was before this book was written, and my thoughts back then represented a pretty accurate portrait of our love and commitment to each other. I'd like to present you with the speech I made that day, which I'm really proud of, but which you should forgive because I was more than slightly intoxicated at the time. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Val Schmerkovsky. I am the best man and, well, I couldn't have thought of a better title. Given the competitive nature of the groomsmen, I will indeed flaunt this one for as long as I can. Jokes aside, the best title I've ever had wasn't necessarily the two world championships that I won, the 15 national titles, or the German Open win. It wasn't the Blackpool title or being named the concertmaster of a youth orchestra at age 15, or being high school valedictorian or a two-time Mirror Bowl winner. And no, not the rock, paper, scissors victory, not the in-house ping pong championship or the three-on-three recreational basketball wins, or that one time they gave me a trophy for smiling the most in second grade. Now if you're thinking, wow, he's certainly not the most humble, you are correct. That is one title that has evaded me for all these years. Nor was I a valedictorian, by the way. I just kind of threw that in there for effect. Anyway, I digress. I was pinned with many titles in life, and some were more dear to me than others. Being a son to the greatest parents of all is up there with hopefully being a decent friend to some. My newly acquired title of being an uncle, boy, was this a special one. Life-changing. It even made it to my Instagram bio. But out of all these titles, the one that has the most presence in my life, the one that is tied to pretty much every important moment I've ever experienced, including the ones I just named, the one I'm most unapologetically proud of, is the title of Max's little brother. Yes, believe it or not, he's older, even though today after shaving, it certainly doesn't look like it. Hey, wait a minute, are you? Yep, I am Max Schmerkovsky's little brother. That's the reply I've played on repeat to the world that has gotten to know us in the last 10 years. You look like that guy from, yep, you mean that brash, emotionally irresponsible, aesthetically exceptional Russian dude from that reality dance show? Yeah, I know. He's my brother. But our life began a long time before the glitz and glamour of Hollywood tried to overproduce a brotherly rivalry that just never existed. My brother and I shared everything together. From the growing pains to personal triumphs. Nothing was ever personal between us. It was always shared. When I hurt, he suffered. And when I won, he celebrated. When life wouldn't even give us lemons, we rallied and planted our own trees. We worked together, sharing the stage at Russian restaurants on Brighton Beach as teenagers, enduring ego checks nightly as the odor of intoxication and herring filled the air. Nonetheless, we gave it our all, trying to perform the best hip action east of the Hudson River. We lived and slept in the same room together, sharing everything from conversations to bunk beds to the adult magazines we used to hide underneath them. From the little apartment in Odessa to the even smaller apartments in New York, we shared it all. I remember Max coming with me to Blackpool one year. We shared a room so small that we had to rest our legs on our suitcases, because only our upper bodies fit on the bed. I remember lying there thinking, wow, this is the greatest shit ever. Since I never felt poor, I never felt small, and I never felt unhappy with you by my side. I once wrote, you are the roof that kept me dry And when I asked to fly, you took me underneath your wing and flew against the wind so high. I wrote that years ago, and I meet it more today than I ever did. We shared it all and continue to do so. Being your brother has by far been the greatest gift the world has ever given me. I am so grateful, especially for that one time when Igor and Alex and I got arrested for truancy in 9th grade and we all had to call our homes. An ass-whooping was inevitable, but not for me. They didn't have an older brother to pretend to be their dad, and I did. They didn't have an older brother to bulldoze through life's disappointments and heartaches as I walked behind enjoying the wisdom of hindsight. It's hard to explain our bond to people while my sense of loyalty and camaraderie is the way it is. Why, as grown men, we still cuddle. Yeah, we still cuddle sometimes when Peter's not looking. Very few will understand what pickles and milk means, or stolen rollerblades, or being a breadwinner at age 17, what it's like to be an example to not just me, but to all my friends. I struggled vicariously through you, and you enjoyed life vicariously through me. I love you, bro. And it is absolutely incredible for me to see someone next to you who loves you even more than I do. Peter Chmerkovsky, a.k.a. Merga Snitch, a.k.a. Lamborghini Mercy, a.k.a. Turnup Extraordinaire, I love you. I love you more than you love the E! Channel and Keeping Up with the Kardashians. I couldn't have imagined my brother sharing the rest of his life with anyone else. You have given him a greater purpose and a greater focus. You truly made him into a man. I've never seen him more in love or more driven than when he's around you. You are his true love, his muse, his wife, his teammate, the point guard to his team. And when ball is life, trust me, that's a huge compliment. I wrote once, "Max, realize that love is really blind, brother. If you stay true to you in time, true love will find you." Looking at you now as man and wife, I can confidently say you both have found true love. I wish the two of you a life of camaraderie, respect, health, and happiness. I hope you two continue to inspire each other, continue to grow together, and continue to be incredible parents that you are. To a few more kids, a lot more smiles, and a lifetime of memories. I love you both dearly. The simple message of the first tattoo I got, family over everything, still holds true above all. At first, it was just those simple 3 words, along with keep it moving, that represented my personal motto. But over time, I went back to the studio for more ink, adding to the design until it took over my whole bicep. My extremely large, I wish, hard as steel, not likely, often shirtless, yep, bicep. I think of that tat now as telling the story of my life, starting out with the core value of family, then getting enlarged with more experiences, more embellishes, more design. And the Chmerkovsky family, we always stay true to our roots. 3 of the guests at Max's wedding were among those original 7 kids who showed up at Rising Stars Open House 2 decades before. Many of my friends are Rising Stars alumni, and many of them have been on Dancing with the Stars as members of the dance troupe. I'm in touch with almost all my competition partners from the past, and I count as close friends the celebrity partners I've worked with, as well as many of their families. This book is a testament to friendships and relationships I've cherished over the years. Their support is another sign for me that what I've written is not just an ego stroke, but a validation of real ties I've made, friendships that weren't just for show and weren't one-sided either, but two-way streets that we built together. Without the friends, allies, mentors, and partners I've had in my life, I would just be a fool dancing alone in a solo spot. My moms and pops, my grandmother in Far Rockaway, we all maintain strong bonds even though we are usually a continent apart. I see them often, and always feel the urge to communicate to my mother and father the gratitude I feel. I want to tell them how grateful I am for all the sacrifices they made for me, for all the tools they've given me, and to assure them that their youngest son is fine and thriving in the world because of the opportunities they provided. Thanks, Max. Thanks, Mom and Pops. I love you more than words can say, even though I've just read 300 pages of words to communicate that fact as best as I can. I've always believed that you're only as good as your last performance. And whatever Dancing with the Stars season I just completed always seems to be my best one yet. It might be a question of me improving all the time. Not so much as a teacher, dancer, or choreographer, but simply getting better at living life altogether. As I write this, I'm in the middle of, yep, my best season ever. That has nothing to do with me and everything to do with the incredible individual that I lucked out getting as a partner. Victoria Arlen is a Paralympic gold medalist from New England with an incredibly inspiring story. She grew up very active and sporty, but when she was 11 years old, she came down with transverse myelitis and an acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, rare infections that made her brain and spine swell. She gradually lost feeling in her extremities, and then her speech went as well. One morning she woke up and found she couldn't move at all. She was locked in, aware, able to hear and think, but incapable of expressing herself. At 11 and a half years old, she heard a doctor inform her parents that recovery was impossible. "She's not gonna make it," said the so-called expert. "You just have to accept the fact that your child is going to die." Imagine Victoria hearing and understanding those chilling words, but being unable to call out, react, or object. The doctors didn't really have a prognosis. They had no idea how to address her condition, and when physicians don't see a clear path to a cure, their reaction can be to throw up their latex-gloved hands in defeat. But her mom and dad were very stubborn people. As parents, they never stopped believing, and they never stopped loving their daughter. They took her out of the hospital and cared for her at home, keeping faith that Victoria would somehow pull through. She was stuck, her body totally non-responsive. Her thoughts grew darker and more blurry, and then just faded to black. 2 years passed. Victoria was in her mid-teens when she emerged from the coma, and her mind came back, too. One day, her mom locked eyes with Victoria and realized that something had changed. "Oh my God," her mother thought. "She's here. There's a consciousness there." "Blink twice if you could hear me," her mother said, overcome with emotion. Victoria started blinking, and that's all that was necessary to move forward with her recovery. She and her family began communicating. She began exercising, and with enough faith and hope, they embarked on a grueling 5-year recuperation just to get Victoria into a wheelchair. 2 years later, she won 3 medals swimming in the summer 2012 Paralympics. She eventually began working as a commentator at ESPN. In 2016, after being paralyzed from the waist down for nearly a decade, she took her first step. A year after that, still with no feeling in her legs, she joined the cast of Dancing with the Stars as a celebrity contestant. The timing of this book, with me reflecting on my life, meditating on all the different blessings that came into fruition, and my desire to pass those blessings forward, I think it all culminated perfectly in my partnership with Victoria. Victoria is not just an American hero for winning medals at the Paralympics. She's a human hero for triumphing over something that universally unites us, our mortality and fight for life. There's no greater example of the human spirit and no better demonstration of strength in family. Ultimately, that's what this book is about. We all have different challenges, and we all have different paths in life. We all have trip-ups along the way, and some of us have bigger trip-ups than others. Some of us can't even feel our legs. But we gotta keep it moving. I began this book by talking about being put into boxes. Racism, anti-Semitism, anti-immigrant bigotry, prejudice against the disabled are all examples of the most deadly kind of labeling. They drain the humanity from individuals and reduce them to stick figures. "Oh, that's the black girl from that singing group. Uh-huh. That's the Hispanic chick who thinks she can be a gymnast. That's the new mother. That's the gay guy. That's the Muslim, the Christian, the Jew. That's the foreigner, the liberal, the conservative. That's the outsider. Look, that's the other. That's the girl in the wheelchair who wants to dance. That's the immigrant. That's the Russian kid who can't speak English. The geek with the stupid kicks whose mom always makes him tuck in his shirt. They don't belong, those people. They can't do it. They. I don't want any part of it. How many roads do we need to walk down before we realize that there is no they? There's only us. Closed-minded attitudes have killed millions over the centuries and are still killing people today. Beyond that, they place a heavy weight on the human imagination, on possibility and self-image. We lose so much when we obsess over differences and ignore our common humanity. But that shouldn't discourage us. It shouldn't discourage all those people moving forward with open-minded attitudes who are seeking to inspire others with their own joy and happiness, sharing the beauty they see in this world. As much as this book deals with negativity, it doesn't dwell on it either. I've been very fortunate that I felt the wind beneath my wings of my family and mentors, and I hope this book can be that for others as well. Meet adversity with a smile and just keep it moving. Take a look at the cast members of Dancing with the Stars. They're like poster children for diversity, for the idea that no single attribute can ever define a creature as complex as a human being. Athletes come on the show and magically transformed into dancers. All flavors, colors, and backgrounds are welcome, with the only qualification being a willingness to learn, grow, and work hard toward a shared goal. I've come to see Dancing with the Stars as a microcosm of the American dream. Over 25 seasons, what's been reflected in the countless mirrors of the Mirror Bowl trophy tells the real truth of what's out there in the world. My experience, as chronicled in this book, is likewise a symbol of what America is all about. I have a fierce allegiance and a wild kind of gratitude toward the country that has given me a wonderful home, and I try to live up to its ideals every day of my life. I've seen America. I've met her by the thousands while out on tour. We've hugged, shook hands, and inspired each other. And I know the goodness that resides in the hearts of her people. We only need to tap into it to make this world a better place. That's the message I've tried to convey in everything I do. Keep the positive, optimistic beat. You can do it. Don't let the naysayers or the judges get you down. With love in our hearts, rhythm in our souls, and a little shimmy in our hips, we can achieve miracles. Be kind. Be great.
This production of I'll Never Change My Name, An Immigrant's American Dream, From Ukraine to the USA to Dancing with the Stars, was read by Valentin Chmerkovsky. It was directed by Dennis Kao and recorded at Outlaw Sound in Hollywood, California. It was produced by Literati Audio. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Valentin Chmerkovsky. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.